Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have someone who I'm so excited to have on. He's a good friend, a colleague, somebody who I respect just immensely. His name is Kerry Lutz, and he is he's a radio show. He has a website, and it's called Financial Survival Network, and people need to go there. Just pencil that in right now, because it's a wealth of information about how our financial system works, how you can navigate it, so you can actually become a student, which is really what it's all about. Knowledge is power. And in the age of coronavirus and various bailouts, I think it's in our interest as American citizens to know what's going on so we can make an informed choice and know what's going on around us. So, Kerry, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know how busy you are, and I've been a guest on your show, and it's always a pleasure to actually interact with you because I learn so much.
And likewise, Dr. George, you've been on the show a lot of times, and I learned things from you that only somebody who's intimately involved in the medical system really is aware of. And then the number of people who actually want to share with non-medical people, lay people, what the truth is very limited. And so you really do a service to all of you out there listening and to me in particular.
Well, thank you. You're so kind. So we got a lot to talk about today. So I want to get started with, first of all, what's your background? How did this move you to become an expert and to share your knowledge with folks?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was a lawyer for 30 years. I was an economics major when I was in Pace University in New York City. But the problem was that the economics department there were total communist socialists. Their main concern was actually unionizing the faculty rather than teaching the students how the economic system worked. So I kind of dropped out of that, had a successful career in business for 30 plus years. And then after the financial crash of 08, 09, I had always wanted to be on the radio, always wanted to talk about these issues that never got talked about, much like you. And I just discovered the world of podcasting, internet on-demand radio, and the rest is history.
Well, we're all the better for it, I have to admit. And I go to your website quite a bit because I want to make sure I understand what's coming down the pipe and how I can not be, what roadkill in the system. So let's get into economics. There's two schools that I'm aware of that seem to be competing, the Austrian economic school and the Keynesian economic philosophy. What's the difference?
Okay, so the Austrian school, so we got to define them. The Keynesian school, John Maynard Keynes, was a major voice in economics in the earlier part of the 20th century, going through, he's long gone, but his influence lives on. And basically, his thing is when there's a business cycle, when we have a recession, a depression, it's up to the government to intervene in the markets, in the marketplace, to pretty much create money out of thin air, inflation, and to keep the economy going, to prime the pump. And it can do this through interest rates. It can do this through loans, whatever. And his influence was profound. It's still with us today. The Austrian school, on the other hand, their theory, their underpinning really summed up, it's been around a long time, but Ludwig von Mises, one of the foremost intellects of the 20th century, one of the most brilliant people, and the people who followed him, like Murray Rothbard, like Friedrich Hayek, all believe that the economy is too complex for it to be directed by any one person or groups of people or the government working in concert, and that the markets function best when they're allowed to function on their own without the input or intercession of the government. And in that, pretty much, if you look at it this way, we're all have money and we're all buying things, so it's effectively an auction. And for business people, the most valuable piece of information is the price, because the price of a given good, if it's, for instance, oil, and it's selling at $40 a barrel, that price sums up all of the players involved, everybody buying and selling, and it tells you, as a business person, what you need to know. But when you manipulate the price, then signals get mixed. Another, for instance, interest rates. The government basically sets the interest rates directly or indirectly. And as a result, they don't know what the actual interest rate should be. And therefore, in the housing crisis, when the interest rate is set too low, you make houses too affordable, effectively, and you wind up having a bubble. You increase the price of these homes, and then you have a bust. And there's a lot of other factors that went into the housing debacle, don't get me wrong, but first and foremost, it has to go to the Federal Reserve for keeping those rates on mortgages too low. And then you just look, interest rates and property, auto loans, student loans, all these things the government has gotten involved in. If you look at the markets that have gotten most twisted and distorted over the past 20 or 30 years, we look at the price of a college education, because most of the financing comes through loans from the federal government. We look at medicine, your profession, because most of the funding that comes for medicine is complements of Medicare and Medicaid. That is the vast majority of dollars going into the medical system. And then we look at housing. Housing's another, for instance, where they manipulate the rates, keep the rates low, so we keep getting ever more debt and ever more escalating prices. The prices of things that have gone up the most over the past 20, 30 years are strictly a result of government intervention, unintended consequences, if you will.
It's so sad. And so if you look at it and take a distant view of this, the people who are socialists seem to be more of the Keynesian model where it's all centralized and planned. This is essentially what you just described. Am I correct? I mean, is this capitalism versus socialism distilled to the economic section?
Yeah, so it's really an erosion of freedom, because free markets lead to free participants, and you decide whether or not you want to be in that market. And look, it's like the price of steak gets too high. You decide, you know what, chicken isn't so bad, and you voluntarily decide that you're going to buy chicken instead of steak. Well, then the government comes in, they say, oh, no, we can't have all these people. They're not buying steak anymore. We're just going to subsidize the price of steak. Then you get excessive demand. You get really shortages. Mm-hmm. If they, you know, the government can do it one of two ways. They could subsidize it, or they could just put a price freeze on the price of steak. Either way, it's going to create a major, major dislocation and poor functioning of the market.
So I know we're going to take our first break in a second, but when we come back, I want to explore that, because this seems to be the meat of why we're in trouble. So let's take our first break. You're living the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're having a very important economic conversation with Mr. Kerry Lutz, and he has a podcast which is world-renowned. He has a website, Financial Survival Network. And before the break, we were talking about the difference in the economic schools of thought. And I was trying to make sure I understood and tie it to what's going on now. Everything is, and you make a statement about everything being more expensive, but you certainly get less of what you're paying for in this system. I mean, education is a cost of a medical school now. I don't know what they're learning in there. The government is deciding winners and losers. And it always seems to be the same people winning. And the people who are complaining about capitalism, that it's the problem, it's actually not the problem, because it's not about freedom of choice and being able to, at least in medicine, I can speak to it with great authority. If the government and if the insurance companies would get out of the way, the price of healthcare would be a lot cheaper. So it's not capitalism, it's crony capitalism that's the problem. What's your take on that?
Well, we don't really have capitalism. As one person called it, we have crapitalism or creditism. Everything is based on credit. And one of the bad things is with credit, like you go to an expensive city and you see that all the products in the stores are more money generally. And then you look and they're in a building and they're paying a high rent. And part of the reason the high rent exists is because the debt on the building is so high, because the government's made it preferable to finance through debt instead of equity through a number of different policies. So when you buy your ham sandwich at a store and it's $5, you know, a dollar of that could be debt. And then if you carry it through all the aspects of production in society, maybe it's 50% of your sandwich, you're helping to pay somebody's debt. And the way that they've done this, you know, government doesn't know best. Yeah, they've done some good things like the space program. You could argue might not have done that without them. Probably the case. You could say safety in autos, pollution controls, those things probably wouldn't have happened. So there is a role for government. Mm-hmm. And but the problem is, like, an agency like the EPA is out of control, and they tie everything up. Until the current occupant of the White House came along, it would take 10 years to get a road approved. And the reason why is so that all of these consultants and parties that feed off of Washington could put your papers together, and it'd be thousands and thousands of pages. And then some bureaucrat would take a rubber stamp and say approved or disapproved. And all of these things really drive up the cost of our day-to-day existence. But more importantly, they impede progress. And progress in terms of, I'm not saying progress good or bad, but in terms of progress is moving ahead. Well, it takes 10 years to build a road. And then by the time the road's approved, that road would be obsolete already. You know, when the government stifles innovation, like, you know, from your own personal experience, the FDA. Right now, we've got these quinine-based drugs. They appear to be amazingly effective treating the coronavirus. And what is the FDA doing? They're tying it up because they're saying, well, if we give it to you, let the COVID-19 patients have it, who it might save their lives. Right. It's going to the people who are getting treated currently with those drugs for autoimmune diseases. So better not to do it. This is the problem when the government's involved. There's no matter what system you have, resources have to get allocated. So if I have to decide to spend $100 to see you to get my ears examined, or not spend that $100 and spend it on something else, I'm making a choice. It's being rationed. But when the government gets in, they tell you who you can see and who you can't see.
Right.
And they're not looking out for the well-being or the best interests of the patient. Their interests are, can we pay for this? What's it going to do to the statistics? All these other issues, much like education, like public school. The actual amount of energy that goes into educating our children is minuscule compared to affirmative action policies, quotas for different things, different reports that have to be submitted to the state to show that you're operating properly, which who knows if they ever read them or not. All these factors just wind up lowering the quality of all the services that you and I have come to rely upon in our lives in a complex society. So I'm not saying that there isn't a role for the government. I think the role of the government is more to act as referee, to pass laws and rules that level the playing field. I know that's a cliche, but that make it easier to compete and easier to provide your service. Right now, I guarantee you that probably a third of your time is taken up with all sorts of administrative nonsense that does absolutely nothing for you to provide quality care to your patients.
No, it's more than a third, unfortunately. And, you know, I think something that we didn't talk about, but that complicates the situation, you made a really interesting statement. They're supposed to be an impartial, player in this, making sure the playing field is level. How on earth can they do that when they are taking money from the same interests that stand to gain? I'm looking at a list, which I'm about to put on Facebook, of the top lobbying spenders in D.C. Chamber of Commerce is number one. National Association of Realtors, pharmaceutical companies, big medicine, you know, the insurance companies, hospitals. They're giving them money and they're not looking out for us because they got their pockets filled by these guys. So what happened to conflict of interest here? Why isn't anybody stopping this process? Because I have a feeling this is the same. I can tell you the chloroquine is an interesting example. The hospitals are stockpiling chloroquine. They're taking it out of the pharmacy. So if I want to write a prescription, my patient can't fill it. Now, if you're thinking about this in terms of public health, wouldn't it be better to have the patient, before they get really sick, if they need to get treated, treat them before they get sick enough to end up in the hospital? Doesn't that make sense to you?
Yeah, of course.
That's not what's happening.
Goal, right? That should always be the goal, is keeping people out of the most expensive section of the healthcare system and allowing them to be treated by the less expensive, equally as effective, or sometimes more effective. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And yet our incentives have gone exactly the opposite. And, you know, when you look at, if you ever go to a hospital and you actually look at your hospital bill after you get out, A, you don't even understand most of the stuff that's on it. And then they charge you $25 for a Tylenol that costs a matter of pennies at the local pharmacy. Something is definitely askew here.
It's definitely askew, but it's the status quo. And unfortunately, the people who are doing the work, like, for example, doctors and the people on the front line, get blamed for a system that they absolutely don't control. And I think this pervades the economy from what you just described. So I know we're going to take a break soon, but I wanted to try to revisit the first bailout, because I think that's an instructive example of what happened when those that stood to gain really got their pockets filled and Main Street got left out in the cold.
Yeah. So the first bailout, there was nothing for the middle class. And you have to understand that the subprime mortgage meltdown was strictly the banks created it themselves, their own misbehavior, with encouragement from the government on a number of fronts. We don't need to get into everything, but it was a creation of the banking industry. Widespread fraud, widespread just unethical maneuvering and manipulation, because the thought is, well, housing prices always go up. So what happened in the bailout? All the banks were insolvent. The government bailed them out by taking preferred stock and putting, you know, $800, $1 trillion. We don't even know how much the Federal Reserve sunk into this endeavor. Mm-hmm. But you calculate it all, at the very least, management, the existing management of these banks, the ones that didn't go out of business, should have been removed and replaced. Instead, they gave them the money, and then they let them take bonuses, inflated bonuses for them and their traders and their management group, and we learned absolutely nothing from it. At least this time, small business is getting some crumbs here. I'm not saying that that it's going to work, but you don't want to have millions of small businesses going out of business, because then you're going to get, you know, 10, 20 million people unemployed. We really don't want that. So I don't think it's a good thing what they're doing, but I don't see where they have much choice. Eventually, the system will have to transform, and it will have to become something else the banks have too much power and they become too big to fail. When they make a mistake, it can have catastrophic results for everyone in society, not just their shareholders and creditors, which is the way it used to be. So we need to split these banks up, break them up, and take their power away and get back to sound money, which is a whole nother discussion.
Well, let's talk about sound money. I mean, at the beginning of the show, you talked about how this is basically just creating money out of thin air, that with the Keynesian model, which we lived under the last administration, I think. How do you get it to be real? Do we have to get rid of the Federal Reserve? Do we have to go to a gold standard? That's a loaded question, but I just like to start that process of that conversation, because I hear so much. You shouldn't have a fiat currency. You should. I'm a little confused myself at this point.
Well, so all currencies are fiat to some extent. The only thing is when it's commodity-based, based on gold or silver or whatever, there's actually a physical asset backing it up. But it's fiat in that the government tells you this is money. I don't see us going to a gold-backed currency again or anything like that. Look, one of the biggest power that a government has, a sovereign entity has, is to create their own money. And this is one of the reasons they don't like cryptocurrencies, because in the end, if cryptocurrencies are allowed to go unchecked, they will eventually take away that sovereign right. And you can argue whether or not the government should have that ability, but really, some type of monetary system, it's got to be somewhat flexible. In terms of what the existing money supply is, like if there's $10 billion in circulation, then that should be backed by an asset, perhaps a commodity. Mm-hmm. But when you've got term deposits, you know, they're in there, a CD for a year or more, or savings accounts, 90-day savings accounts, those aren't really part of the money supply. They don't need to be backed up. And throughout the history of monetary systems, those types of things weren't backed up because that's how banks loan money. We have a whole bunch of issues in the banking system. They actually create money out of thin air. So when there is an upward cycle going, they keep pumping in more and more money. And the way things are set up now, they can really pump in infinite sums of money into the system, and that has potential catastrophic results as well.
On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Kerry Lutz, and he is the owner of the website Financial Survival Network. And he has a podcast. And Kerry, tell us a little bit about how people can access your podcast.
Oh, sure. Thanks for that. And you can just go to the website, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. All 7,000 shows that I've done since I started 9 years ago are up there in the archives. And feel free to take a look and listen to what we were telling you back in 2009, that the next financial crisis would be far worse than the than that one, of course, which it was, is, it's unfolding now. So all of these things, it's all there on the site. We also put a lot of articles from other writers and content creators up there. So it really gives you, my intention is not to tell you what to think, but to give you the information so that you can think on your own.
That's exactly the motto of our show. You know, I think knowledge is power. You have to have all of it in order to make an informed choice. And whatever is good for you may not be good for me. I just don't want someone to tell me how to think and what to do. And I love your site because it's about giving you a broad range of people who are thinkers. So let's go back. Let's revisit this economic system that we're in. I want to play devil's advocate for a minute. I want to get your take. If you ran the country, if you had ultimate power, how would you fix this? I think you're not a fan of the bailout, you said. But what if you could, you know, wave a wand? What would you do to make this stop and make it better so we stop going through these cycles of nonsense?
I wish I had all the answers, but I don't. And you have to have a transition period to transition to the next economic system, because this one has too many inequities. It encourages too much bad behavior, and it winds up, when it's working really well for a large chunk of the population, but a large chunk is also disenfranchised. So you've got to come up with a system where the banks don't have, the financial institutions have so much power. The internet's in the process of moving us there anyway. We see startup websites like Kickstarter, like GoFundMe, sites like those that are cutting out the middleman. We see the blockchain, which will eventually cut out the stock exchanges. All of these things, we're kind of moving there. We kind of have to allow the transition to take place and start kind of pulling back the reins of government and really get out of the way. The return back to free markets, we can't do it in one day, because then we'll have a massive depression with millions and millions of people dying, because in 08 and 09, they said that the food trucks, the trucking companies that bring the food from the farm to the supermarket, that we were 3 days away from them stopping, because banks, nobody trusted their letters of credit. And as a result, the Federal Reserve had to jump in there and backstop guarantee all bank letters of credit. So we don't want that to happen, obviously. So the thing is to find government agencies that we can just eliminate, scale out, and get rid of over time, and really just start taking an approach to roll back government. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we roll back government, the role of the banks will get rolled back as well, because one of their major purposes in life is to facilitate the smooth functioning of the federal government. But as we know, the federal government is dysfunctional and can never have enough money. So the more the deficit goes up, the banks love it, because they get to finance the deficit by selling treasury bills and such. So really, it's got to be a transition, and it's got to be a kind of compact between our leaders and the people that this is the best thing to do for all parties concerned. And here's how we're going to have to do it. The last government agency I remember going by the wayside, I think, was the Interstate Commerce Commission. And used to every commercial vehicle that crossed the state line had to have an ICC number, a registration, which did absolutely no good whatsoever. But somehow they managed to get rid of it. And nobody, I don't hear anyone clamoring, gee, I wish there was an Interstate Commerce Commission again. I really miss them. They did such good. The same with the CAB. They were the Civilian Aeronautics Board, and they controlled all the prices that airlines charged. If you wanted to do a substitute Pepsi for Coke in an airplane meal, which we don't even have anymore, they had to approve of it. Literally, they micromanaged the whole industry. Once they were done away with, air travel got way, way cheaper. In some ways, it got worse, but in some ways, it got better. It's safer than ever, and it is the safest way to get around, and more people fly than ever before. And if the CAB was still there, who knows what would have happened. So we need to identify these agencies and get rid of them without a second thought. Like the Department of Education, perfect example. It was started, I can't remember who started it, maybe back in Reagan or before. And since they came into power, education has gotten worse. I don't blame them for it. Okay, because there's a lot of factors involved, unionization, politicization of the schools becoming indoctrination centers, all these things. Mm-hmm. I'd even add to that removing God from the classroom. All these things led to lower standards and less productivity. So less productivity in terms of students actually learning what they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. So we certainly could spur a system, a competitive system, and get rid of the Department of Education altogether, because it does no good whatsoever. It does more harm than good. EPA, a lot of what they do is no good. So the key is to rein in the functions of government and the spending, and then in the form of reduced taxation and reduced regulatory burden, the economy will grow on its own. And if we had a regime in place to cut back 5% of government operations a year till we get down to the one-third that's basically necessary, and we go back to the founding fathers, and the Austrian economists are very instructive here. The function of the government is, one, to protect from enemies within and without. Number two, it's to provide for a mechanism for its inhabitants to peacefully settle disputes, the courts, another thing that they do horribly. Number three is protect the integrity of the free market. And there's not a lot of other functions. That doesn't mean subsidizing electric car makers, solar panel manufacturers, all these things. I mean, you just have to look in New York to see what happens there. When was it? Back in 2012, Governor Cuomo had a choice. He could spend $567 million on 16,000 ventilators. Now, I don't know whether that was a good idea or not. It sure looks like it maybe would have been a good idea now, but who knows if those things even last for 8 years in storage, especially with the government looking after them. Half of them could have gotten stolen, but let's assume. But instead, he finances a entity, Elon Musk-backed entity in Buffalo that's going to make solar cells. And now that spent like $750 million on it, and that factory is shuttered. So when you get the government doing stuff that they shouldn't be doing, then we work best when we have a limited number of tasks to accomplish in a particular time. When we have too many tasks and our attention is squandered, we really suffer. Our output suffers. And that is why government needs to be minimized. Can you imagine them like taking over the half of the medicine that they don't already control?
It would be over, and it would be like Italy, where if you're over 60, they're not treating you at all, or Spain. It would be rationed to the nines, and anybody who's in the mindset of single payer being the panacea is, I mean, you should just look at what's going on in Europe. And it's interesting. I listened to a YouTube last night, and the countries that are doing the worst, the people with the highest mortality rate, are all socialized medicine countries. It's not the ones with a private sector to their healthcare system. This is a wake-up call for people before we start to implement this system is, you know, medicine is our, healthcare is a right. It's not a right, it's a service, and it is a personal responsibility. And I think that whole mindset, someone's going to pay for it so I can do whatever I want, and I'm going to be bailed out. And that goes from the business side. Like you mentioned, Elon Musk and those guys, they still get money for their failures. But you and I, if we don't do the right thing, we won't be in business. No one's bailing us out. So there has to be some consequence without some entity coming in to fix it. Because these guys are just, it's playing casino, isn't it? It's just a roulette of whatever goes. I can make any mistake I want because I'm going to be made whole. And let's take our last break, because I want to ask you about that, because I think the banks ended up doing that initially, did they not? So let's take a break, and our last break, you're Living in Solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Kerry Lutz, and has a radio show, as I said before, that's well-renowned. He's interviewed everybody from Peter Schiff to Jim Rogers, Martin Armstrong. He releases segments on iTunes and YouTube, and people should subscribe to both of those. And I love your motto about the Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next. And that's it. It's about not taking it, right? It's trying to be proactive, forward thinking, so you can navigate the system and not be injured, in my opinion. Before the break, we were getting into how to fix the problem. Let's talk about what is now. You know, we have this, hopefully soon they'll vote on this bailout. And what do you think it's good about it? What should I, as a small business owner, or if I were an independent contractor, and I'm I'm really sitting there in my dining room table wondering if I have to fire my employees or not. Will this help me? Will this help the average person?
It's definitely going to help you for a while. And if we know government, we know anything about government, this is probably the first of several, if not many, bailouts. Because it's cheaper for them to just pay you to pay your employees than it is for you to fire your employees. Then they go on unemployment. Then they go on all these other government services. So from an economic standpoint, it probably isn't going to change the outcome any, but the government's going to pay for it one way or the other because they box themselves into all of the whole social safety net. So they might as well just pay you to not fire your employees than to pay your employees after you fire them. It probably makes some sense. Even if it came out to the exact same dollar amount, having people, quote unquote, productive is a better outcome than having them unemployed. We're only in this situation because of the government in the first place, because they blew that bubble up from 08 and 09. I think it was Talleyrand's saying, we've learned nothing and we've forgotten nothing from 08 and 09. And exactly the things that got us into 08 and 09, yeah, we don't have people doing liar loans anymore, but we've got an over-leveraged system, a weakened global financial system, and all it took was something to be labeled as a pandemic that really probably isn't or is mild, relatively speaking, compared to the common flu. And we saw that that this destabilized the entire system. Maybe the government's reaction to it is the destabilizing force factor, but it was going to happen. And it was this. So maybe it's better that it's this. You know, there's benefits to this thing. I mean, it drives you a little crazy hanging out at home all day doing nothing. But on the other hand, neighborhoods kind of rediscovering each other, neighbors, and other things. But getting back to your question of what do we do, it really is elimination of government programs, elimination of government departments, and reining in the banks, breaking them up. Concentration of industry turned out to be the worst thing ever. Now, yes, there are certain efficiencies. If you have 10 banks and they all have presidents and all the management infrastructure, if you have one, then you've cut out all those layers of redundancy. The negative part is those 10 community banks knew everybody in the town. They knew if they loaned to John Doe, they would get paid back no matter what happened. But if they loaned to Mary Rowe, she was a deadbeat, so they wouldn't loan to her. And nothing to do with the sexes, by the way.
No, I'm not like that. Don't worry.
Well, I've got yelled at for that. But in any event, you know what I'm saying is the concentration of the banking system has been a horrible failure. It needs to be reversed. And the concentration in most industries has been a really glaring negative. In airlines, it's led to decreased service. It's led to bad service, higher prices, less choice. You know, and you see this all over. Like Marriott took over Starwood, and Starwood had an incredible rewards program, the best there. I mean, I'd been a loyal Starwood customer for years, and Marriott takes them over. The first thing they do is chop that thing in half. So your rewards are 50% of what they were. And who's to complain about it? Because Marriott runs like 60% of all the hotels and or more than that. So concentration of industry is to be frowned upon, except in extreme cases. And I don't want the government picking who can merge and who can't, but I want them to have strict rules to discourage the practice for the sake of, I mean, why did they do it? So company A gobbles up company B, they cut back on the cost and thousands of employees, then company A has a higher per share profit, and then their stock goes higher, and then the bonuses kick in for management. And that's why they do stock buybacks, the same exact thing. If we're making $1 a share with 100 shares, if we have 50 shares, we'll make $2 a share, and my bonuses will go up. So the selfishness, the greed of management in all of these large entities, the corporatist takeover of the country, and understand they couldn't have done it without the aid and being aided and abetted by government. All that needs to be rolled back. And basically, our Congress needs to either resign or be indicted, and term limits, all these things. A lot of it's impractical. A lot of it's never going to happen. But it's what's necessary to stop making the same mistakes.
You know, maybe it could happen. I think this whole process has outed a lot of nefarious intent in Congress. I mean, people who, I think the big business Chamber of Commerce went up there a couple days ago whining about how they need to keep their business in China because of their investments overseas. Who cares about their investments overseas? I think not only is it bringing people together, but if it's now opening up the minds of people that you shouldn't have pharmaceuticals and, you know, really important industry in countries that we don't, that don't like us, or that we can't control ourselves, or if the pipeline that dries up, we're screwed. This is a wake-up call. We need to, you know, bring everything as much as we can back and not outsource everything, which is in the interest of big business. So I think that, to me, has been a positive. And anybody who's whining about their bottom line versus patient health, the health of the country, I think that it's now exposed where their loyalties lie.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the meanings of the word apocalypse means the unveiling. And through Donald Trump running for president, whatever you think about him, he unveiled everybody on the right and left for exactly who they were. Whether you love them or hate them, you should be grateful for that, because you know exactly where these people stand now. They were wearing masks, and he unmasked the entire elite political class, and regardless, irrespective of political party, these were people who were really treasonous, and they're still there, and they're out to screw over the country, like the Chamber of Commerce, which would like to outsource every job in the country to China to greatly enhance the profits of their members. That's what they're about. They're one of the most evil entities. They're the glue that holds together corporatism in the United States.
I would absolutely agree with that. And they have their cronies in Congress who work right along with them. And, you know, the other thing about the insider trading, when they sat in for the pandemic, I guess the congressional notification, and then they sold stock immediately after and made bucks off of it. Isn't that illegal? And why aren't they arrested?
Yeah, isn't that great? Isn't that great? Well, insider trading supposedly was outlawed by the Congress. Yeah. Then they upped the law. But it's all about it. Like, you know, these people, look, years ago they were honest. They went to Congress to become millionaires. Now they hide and they say, well, we're there for the good of the people, but they're still there to line their pockets. And every level of government in our country is corrupt in most states. Mm-hmm. But you always have to realize. And it doesn't matter where you are or what you're doing. You know, some places aren't quite as bad as others. Maybe it's better in Utah, but they have Mitt Romney, so I don't know. but you know that it's really, really bad, and it needs to be dealt with, or it will be the decline and the downfall of our country.
I agree with you. Now, I actually have a thought about how, if I ran it, I wonder if this would crash everything. But why don't we make them take the haircut for a change? So, if you have a student loan, and I'm not a socialist in any stretch of the imagination, but maybe you should have a cutoff on how long people have to pay. If you've been paying for 10, 15 years and you still owe, just stop it, right? You're never going to pay it off. It becomes this long-living debt that you
just... You're a debt slave.
Yeah, you are. Debt slave. So you paid for 15, 20 years and then you're done, period. Or if you have a mortgage because You know, they sold your mortgages to companies that didn't, it was just totally toxic and fake. Then cut half your mortgage debt. Or if you've had mortgage for 25, 30 years, then it stops. You know, something that people can get out from under the yoke of this system. You're paying for a system that's broken, that's robbing you, and they've been living large off of us for God knows how long. I say the haircut has to be foisted on them for a change.
I totally agree with you. And the best idea I heard for dealing with student loans is just make them interest-free.
That'd be cool.
Because you're paying many times, it's worse than a mortgage, mm-hmm. paying many times your principal in interest. And let's cut the interest rate down on every single government loan and the private ones as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because they're printing up the money, they're getting it for nothing. The banks literally create the money out of thin air. Doesn't cost them anything. They charge the Federal Reserve for the Federal Reserve to print the money, give it to the banks, and then loan it to the government. It sounds like there's something a little amiss with that system, doesn't it?
Oh, you bet it does.
So, hey, just remember what my partner always said to me. My partner, David, I'll never forget. He's 20 years older than me and 20 years more experienced and wiser. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but he always used to say, Kerry, the situation is hopeless, but never serious. And that's how I keep my bearings. Yes, it's serious from the standpoint that it's bringing us down and it's hopeless. But it also brings back a memory that's attributed to Churchill, but I don't know if he said it. God looks after children, drunks, and the United States of America. So sense of humor, really, really important. Read the works of H.L. Mencken. He was the foremost political satirist of his time 100 years ago or so. He actually worked for the Baltimore Sun, which is a total rag in this day and probably won't survive much longer. But his wit and his observations of politicians in America are universal and well worth absorbing.
I agree. Now, in the few minutes that I think we have a minute or so left, how can people reach you? And I mean, this is such a complex system of this debt and this bailout. Is it something that you think you can be a resource for folks and if they reach out to you?
Absolutely. If you're a small business person and you've been hurt by this this depression, and it's nothing short of a depression, you might as well get the most you can from the government because they help drive you where you are now. I can help you navigate the maze of government red tape and regulation, although there's a lot less to get this money. I can show you how to maximize your amount of stimulus and how to really, really get back on your feet and really take it to the next level, if you will. You just have to email me, kl@kerrylutz.com. I'll help coach you through the process. Hasn't been passed yet, the bill, but I've been following it literally minute by minute, change by change, so I can help you get to where you need to go. And you can always go to my website, financialsurvivalnetwork.com, and just fill out a contact sheet either way. But best way is just to email me, kl@kerrylutz.com. Can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity to appear on your show and share my limited wisdom with your audience, who I'm sure is very astute and really there.
Oh, I love my audience, and I love you too. Thank you so much for coming on. It was an education for me, and I'm sure it was for them as well. I look forward to having you back on again.
And I look forward to coming back on. You know, you're one of those rare people, Dr. George, who, you know, really touches people in a very meaningful way and really helps people, both in your medical practice and in your show here. You're really open, honest, and authentic, and for that, you really are to be applauded.
Oh, you made my day. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Living in the Solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.